just to be close to you, girl. Just for a moment, well, just for an hour, just to be close to you, girl. You know, I've been through so many changes in my life, girl. Oh, I've been up real high where I thought I didn't need anybody. Oh, and then again, I've been down real low where there was no one in my life that needed me. Oh, and I found that material things I thought had so much value. Oh, girl, didn't really have any value at all. That I was a lonely man, a man with no direction, with no purpose, with no one to love and no one to love me for me. Oh, girl, then you came into my life. You made my jagged edges smooth. You made my...
Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm going to pump the brakes right there. I just felt like a little bit of Commodore of the Day, you know, because I know a lot of us in this world can relate to that song one way or another. Welcome to Can a Player Play. It's your host, Lamont Patterson. Welcome to the show. We have a very, very great, great show lined up for you today. Our special guest today is author Dewey B. Reynolds. He's going to talk about his interesting past history, his books, and let us know what we got going on today in his life, and definitely going to talk about a very important subject that we're all dealing with before and still today, dealing with racism and prejudices and all kind of different stuff. But anyway, let me see, is Mr. Reynolds with us? Are you with us, Mr. Reynolds?
I am with you, sir. How are you today?
I am fantastic. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Mr. Reynolds, let me give everyone, our listeners, a brief introduction, and hey, we'll dive right in. Today we have Mr. Dewey B. Reynolds, author of Chronicles, his Interracial Parents, Dangerous Criminals, and we're definitely going to jump into that. Dewey B. Reynolds is author, screenwriter, short filmmaker, and computer expert. Dewey began writing short stories, poetry at the high school level and recognized he has true ability to write. Several years after leaving high school, he decided to research the background of both his parents. Later, he would learn that they were hardened criminals who operated vice on the streets of Kansas City, Missouri, during the 1960s. After many years of tireless research, he wrote a book entitled Two Shades of Ice, based on the true story of interracial couples' life together in crime. Dewey has also written a fantasy trilogy series about a character named Stuart Duffelmeyer. Thrill is also genres in which he has written two other books. And again, welcome, 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 sir.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Oh, man, we appreciate you for taking time out of your busy day to come join us.
Okay, thank you.
Man, I'm definitely interested, man. So let's just dive in, man. First, tell me about Dewey. I think I read somewhere that you were given it to an orphanage or something.
Yes. Well, at the age of 6 months, me, my brother, and my sister were placed in foster care because of our parents' criminal lifestyle, and they were almost like criminals on the run from the law, and they really couldn't provide a stable home because of that, and they just pretty much dropped us off and never came back. And of course, documentation that I received from the Division of Family Services explained why all this took place and how my parents' parental rights were eventually terminated because of that. And course, I wanted to learn more, and that's what prompted me to write, you know, my nonfiction book, Two Shades of Vice, based on the true story of an interracial couple's life together in crime.
Well, tell us, well, I guess we can start there. I mean, tell us about that. I mean, how that started. I know as a child, I know that question was always there in regards to your parents.
Well, like I said, I'd always wonder where I came from and who my mother and father, because I would eventually learn that I was not in my natural surroundings or with my natural parents. So I wanted to know what they looked like, what they were about, where did they come from, who their parents were, maybe did they have other children, and it just a whole lot of different things I wanted to know about them. So what really opened the door to that was when I went over to the Division of Family Services to get some documentation about my stay in the foster home, because I was there for 15 years. From 6 months to 15 years until the foster mother died, I went to live with a friend of hers until I finished high school. But when I was reading over documentation about me, my brother, and my sister staying in this foster home, it was saying in part of the narrative that they were hardened criminals and, you know, they had extensive criminal records. So I said, wow, that kind of like, you know, turned that light on inside my head. So I said, let me go over here to the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department and kind of like, you know, look into their criminal background. And, man, I tell you, after I got all these documents or these sheets about, you know, these police reports and then these criminal rap sheets and everything, I was like, wow, I could not believe that I come from a mother and a father that did all these things. And to learn that my father did, like, prison time in five different states, I mean, that –
wow.
That really shut me out there in outer space somewhere. I was really blown away. So to learn about their whole criminal history and all the crimes that they were involved in, oh, my God, that took me for a tailspin. My head was spinning after I learned all this.
Was this book difficult for you to write about, or was it exciting, or was it a little mixture of both?
I would say it was a mixture of both. It was exciting, and it was kind of, I wouldn't use the word sad, but it was eye-opening, I would say, and it kind of like, gave me answers to a lot of unanswered questions. And I guess the exciting part was, like I said, just to be able to obtain information that really went into, like, deep detail about all the facets of crime that they were involved in. And like I said, to learn that my father didn't know, he was a white man, my mother was a black woman, and to learn that he did prison time in five different states, which included Missouri, Illinois, Texas, California, and Arizona. So that told me, wow, this guy got around. This man really made his rounds. And to know that my mother was out on the streets soliciting prostitution and, you know, and consorted with a lot of prostitutes. And then also, I think what was the highlight of learning all this information and gaining all this information was to learn that my father consorted with, like, well-known gangsters, a lot of Italian gangsters here in Kansas City, and how he actually did some work for them as far as, like, robberies and break-ins and hijackings and you name it. So, But to answer the question, though, yeah, I mean, it was more so exciting just to learn all this and, you know, just be able to find this information that I had been trying to find for so many years, and it kind of brought closure, too, so I was really glad about that.
Right. Your father being white Irish American and your mom being African American, I mean, mm-hmm. What part of your life did you find that out, or did you find that out early on?
Yeah, my foster mother disclosed that to us that, you know, we was a mixed parentage. You know, we were interracial, and you know, pretty much prior to that, I had never seen what they looked like. I was only told, you know, it was like a verbal thing. The foster mother told us, yeah, well, you have, you know, a white father and you have a black mother, and you know, kind of, you know, of mixed parentage. And of course, we talk like maybe late 60s, early 70s before we even found out, because I was born in 1964. And it was kind of still taboo, I guess you could say, back then. And, you know, the people, it was kind of like still not really accepted by society, whether it was like within the black community or within the white community. So, but I would eventually go on to meet them and, you know, see what they look like. So, oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, I know you mentioned briefly that your mom was, you know, involved in solicitation, prostitution. What other type of vices were they involved in, if I could ask that?
Wow. That right there, I'll tell you, that stretches probably from New York to California. But, no, on a serious note, as far as my mother's, in, like, when I reviewed her criminal rap sheet that was given to me by the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, the Records Division, wow, I mean, solicitation of prostitution, petty larceny, vagrancy, theft, wow. I think maybe there's some other things, forgery and stuff like cashing bad checks and all that. But as far as my father, I mean, he had a very – well, most of my mother's convictions was for prostitution. You know, she had, like, maybe 20-something convictions over, like, a 10-year period for just, like, ongoing for prostitution. Now, as far as my father, his rap sheet includes things like burglary and larceny, highway robbery, stealing gas ration coupons during World War II, hijacking, selling or fencing stolen goods, let me see, solicitation of, like, illegal firearms, things like, let me think, cash and bogus checks, let me think, I've already said robbery, breaking and entering, drunken driving, suspicion of murder. And you just, I mean, it was just like the list just went on and on and on. And he had a very extensive criminal rap sheet that, my God, I mean, it's almost like you say, you name it, he did it. So when I reviewed his rap sheet,
he was a busy man, wasn't he?
Yeah, I would say, to be honest with you, the man was a gangster. I mean, he wasn't your Al Capone or your John Gotti or Carlo Gambino type of gangster, but the man was a gangster. He just, crime was his life. And then when they get to the end of the his criminal rap sheet, they tell you, this known subject has never, ever shown any known legitimate occupation, which basically is saying he never worked a legitimate job a day in his life.
Well, I guess my question would be, and I'm going to be neutral on this because I am the talk show host, I guess in his era and where he was doing his thing, I mean, I guess it could be construed that it was a legitimate occupation to him. I mean, especially if he was in survival mode, let me put it that way.
Right. You know what? You're exactly right, sir, when you say survival mode, because maybe he saw that as only his only means of survival. So, you know, he felt as though, you know, why go in and punch a time clock for someone when basically, you know, I can go out on the streets and I can hustle. I mean, I can sell drugs. I can, you know, I can rob people. I can break in people's houses. I can steal cars, or I can do all that. Because in some of the police reports, it says that my mother and father operated a body house together where, you know, they ran prostitution through there, illegal whiskey, contraband cigarettes, frozen meats, narcotics. I mean, they was just doing everything in this house. And it was just money. He had bought this house for money that he had made in vice. And they were making lots of money, especially from the prostitution end, because they would have a lot of, per se, suburbanite white men come down into the inner city to pick up black women. And a lot of times, some of the women had pimps, and they would take them to these seedy motels and stuff and do their business and then leave. But my father had it set up where the women who worked for him, because he was a pimp, because in a couple of the police reports, it says that he was a known procurer. He was known to the police as being a pimp. And his girls would bring the tricks to that body house that him and my mother operated. My mother pretty much ran the prostitution end of the house while he, you know, did the narcotics and did the whiskey and the beer and the cigarettes and all that. So it's quite interesting. It really is.
Yeah, I could see that definitely that it would be. Tell us about some of the people that were involved in Two Shades of Ice.
Wow. Well, I mean, when you say the people were involved, like, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, coming up along the way, you had to interact with some other people that write this. Before we jump into that, I think we have somebody else want to answer a question really quick, and I'm going to let them jump in, and then we can go to that question.
Okay.
111, you're on.
Hey, Dean.
How are you?
I'm doing just fine. I'm sitting here listening, and I almost hate that you opened my line because I am so intrigued by the story. Personally,
thank you.
I want to congratulate you on your life and overcoming all of these obstacles. And I want you to know this. As I was trying to look for every bit of information that I could, but this is the first thing that comes to my mind, that there are so many people who have experienced the things that you have,
mm-hmm.
but they never accomplish or never seem to, how do I say, come around to a level of conscientiousness
mm-hmm.
where they can take themselves outside of that detriment that they were born into. And I'm using detriment for lack of a better word, only because I'm thinking about your parents' criminal history.
Uh-huh.
But you were able to step outside of that, being the writer that you are, and
uh-huh.
paint a picture for us so that we can understand what life was like back then. Because I want you to know, you are, I'm not going to say that you are another Robert Beck, because you are an individual. You know I'm talking about Iceberg Slim. But
yeah.
here you go giving us an actual vivid picture of
uh-huh.
what Iceberg Slim was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking, I'm listening to you. When I was like 8 years old, I was an avid reader. And
yes.
I would hide and read Donald Goings and Iceberg Slim books. So
mm-hmm.
I know about Pimp and Black Mama Widow. And when I'm listening to you,
uh-huh.
You paint a vivid picture because you talk about your parents.
Yes.
See, that's the difference between you and Robert Beck. Now,
yeah.
my question to you is this.
Mm-hmm.
I can ask you this quick question in order to ask you the question firstly.
Yes, ma'am.
How much time did your dad do in jail? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, the longest, according to his criminal rap sheet, the longest stretch of time that he ever did, and it was in the Missouri State Penitentiary, was for robbery, and he did 10 years for that. But he also did time in Arizona for cashing bogus checks. He did, I think, 4.5 or 5 years in Texarkana, Texas, because he was down in Dallas, and he had stole a lot of gas ration coupons that the government had issued during World War II, and he did about 4.5 to 5 years for that. And then he did time in Bakersfield, California, for stealing cars. And so the man made his rounds. He definitely made his rounds. But to answer your question, man, the longest stretch of time that he ever did was in 1932 for robbery in the Missouri State Penitentiary.
Okay. Now that answers my question. Here's my question to you.
Uh-huh.
So I'm listening to you, and your dad is a white man, your mom black.
Yeah.
Now, could it be that your dad had the advantage? He still had a white man's privilege, being that had he been a black man, I think he would still be in the penitentiary today as an old man, or maybe have died in there. Because when I hear you talk about what he did was, I think he realized that when he did these crimes that were crimes against white men or the establishment is when he really got spanked on the hand. But
yes.
it seems like to me, with the prostitution and pimping in the black community, he was able to stay afloat and stay under the radar because those crimes were not indicative of doing time. And I guess what I'm trying to say is they really didn't care. Does it seem like that?
Well, you know what,
you
raise a very good point, because me and a couple of friends of mine kind of laugh about that, because we know them areas here in Kansas City very well where, because at his height, he had like 6 or 7 women on the streets for him. My mother was out there one time, but she came in. She quit that and came to work for him and run the girls for him and run the tricks through the house, in and out the house. But we often laugh about that because it's not really always a joking matter, but how a white man can be down into a black community soliciting black women on the streets in a black community. Because normally it's like, okay, well, if she's a colored woman, as they call them back then, she's probably going to have a colored pimp. She's not going to have no white pimp. But from what I understand, from the information that I received, and from what I hear out on the streets from the old timers, and from even what my mother told me, God rest her soul, he had a white girl working for him, and he had like maybe 5 or 6 black women working for him at his height, as far as him being a procurer, being a pimp. And he did all this in the black neighborhood because as a white man, he knew that other white men, whether they were from somewhere near the inner city or out in the suburban areas, desired black women for sexual pleasure, for their little, you know, rendezvous that they would have with the dalliances, if you will, with black women. And my father knew that, and I believe he capitalized on that. He knew he could make money from these white men and their lust and their desire for black women.
Of course. Mm. I can honestly see the relationship between the two. Your dad was a gangster, and your mom was a gangster, too. So she saw the benefits of the both worlds, too.
Exactly. That's how they put their heads together. They knew in a life of crime they can make money. They can survive. They weren't going to become rich and live a lavish lifestyle from a life of crime, but they just knew together, if they put their heads together and maybe a few little resources that they had at the time, that they could really make some money. And they made a pretty substantial amount of money. And then,
of course, it all came crashing down
around them.
Can I, before you guys let me go, can I find out where I can get the book now? How can I get it?
Right now, the book is for sale on Amazon. It's in print edition and also an ebook edition. And also, you can go to my website at www.DeweyReynoldsBooks.com. That's www.DeweyReynoldsBooks.com. But you can go on Amazon and look for Two Shades of Vice, based on the true story of an interracial couple's life together in crime. You can go there to get it.
Okay, great. And lastly, how do you feel about Robert Beck, a.k.a. Iceberg Slim, and his novels?
I saw a documentary about a year ago on Iceberg Slim, and I know one of his most famous works was Trick Baby. Of course, I saw the movie Trick Baby, too. And, I commend the man. I mean, he's gone now. The man is gone, but I commend him because he had something to talk about. It may have not been the most glamorous type of story or the most, you know, Christian-like type of literature or something that was so wholesome and clean and pure and all that. But the man had a story to tell. He had several stories to tell, and I commend him for telling those stories. So, you know, I feel as though if you got a story to tell, no matter what level it's on, whether it be something of prominence or something that's dealing with the hardcore street gangster life, then I say tell your story. So he felt as though he had something to talk about, and he told his story, and I admire him for that.
Yes, sir, because your dad certainly reminds me of white folks. You know that character,
yeah, yeah.
Right, folks?
It'll put you in that mind because before you go, ma'am, off the air, it's like, see, not only was my father this procurer, because it's mentioned in police report, because people often say, well, how do you know these things? Well, I have actual documentation, you know, notarized documentation proving who they were and what they did. So this is not stuff that I dreamed up or somebody told me. I have proof. But Bob, what I was going to say is that not only was he soliciting, had women out there working for him, but they, from time to time, they would set tricks up to get robbed, just like you saw in the movie, just like you saw in Trick Baby, how he would set some of those tricks up to get robbed. And they were into doing things like that, too, especially when they knew the guys had money, when they carried around pockets full of money and everything, they would set them guys up to get robbed.
You know, I want to say this to you. I wish you nothing but the best. I'm going to purchase your book. It is my hope that you bring this to film, that you have this manifested in film, and so that people can, because not only, I want to say this to you, and I want you to know I'm serious. This is the story of some lives that were lived, be it good, bad, or indifferent. But the greatness about it is the offspring that was able to arise above all the muck and mire and tell the people the story. That's what I want us to get. Do we understand through whose eyes and mind and belly this story is being told? See, we need to respect that.
Yes.
And I want to say this. One thing about that white man, I'm looking at the pictures of your mom and her profile where you can see her from the side. I guess that's the booking picture.
Yeah, it was booked.
Just regal. Look at her face, perfectly chiseled. You see what I'm saying?
Yes,
and
I
think your dad figured out that, you know, these white girls bring too much heat in here. He got one. He probably said, no, I can do better in this black neighborhood. And I'm, like you said, I'm laughing, but it's not funny. But that is, even as a criminal, the white man has privilege.
No question.
I get so many things from your story, and I want
you
to know it's valuable.
Well, ma'am, I was just going to say it's a very powerful story. It took me several years to write it. It took me quite a while to get all my research material, all the police reports and criminal rap sheets, and also information that my mother actually told me before she died in 1999. And from even some of the old-timers out on the streets that knew my father, the ones that probably in their 70s and 80s are still around, have told me stories. I knew your father, Mac Reynolds. Everybody called him Mac. Well, his name was Gordon Reynolds, but everybody called him Mac. But all in all, it's a very powerful story. They have some strong content in there, but it tells a very, very good story. And I believe that many people would get so much out of it because it crosses so many different racial lines, gender lines, age lines, you know, economic lines. And I just know it's a good story, and I feel so confident about it.
And you should, because it's tangible for today. And lastly, please don't let anybody steal it from you. Promise me you will not let people steal your life's work from you, because that's what happens to people. Now, I'm going to get out of the way and let you all go on and talk, but please don't let anyone steal your
work. I enjoyed talking
to
you, ma'am, and thank you very much, and I think you will enjoy reading the book.
All right. You guys have a good one.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, caller. Please stay tuned. Dewey, I had a question too, because you know, I'm hearing you talk about your mother and your dad, and you know, I could say, you know, they both were gangsters, not in a negative sense, but in a survival sense, you know, doing what they were doing in their era, and they both saw the benefit of playing both sides of the fence. But I guess my question, fast forward, is to you. Because do you or have you ever thought about the entrepreneurial spirit that you have today, you got from your dad and your mama?
You know what, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked it, because I work for the IRS, and a manager at work, even before I wrote this book, I would show her, like, police mug shots of my mother and father and some of the documentation that I had. And, you know, she had come to learn from just me talking about it, how my father, you know, was this career criminal. He had done crime almost his entire life until his health failed him. But she said, you know what, your father may have done what he did, like in a criminal negative sense. You know, he was an entrepreneur, but I see you being an entrepreneur in the sense, in a more positive way. You know, you have those genes that he have. But you taking it in a different direction, as far as, like, you know, not the criminal element, or, you know, or doing what he did, but doing something positive, something creatively, because I feel as though I'm a very creative person. He was creative, but he was creative in a criminal sense. I feel as though I'm creative as far as, like, you know, creating stories and characters and literature and all that, and being, expressing myself with poetry and literature and books and novels and all that. So,
I have it, but
it's in a different
sense.
Was
making alcohol illegal before they said it was?
Well, we're talking like the late 50s, pretty much throughout most of the 60s, up until like maybe the middle or late 60s. But see what it was. Okay, here's as far as the alcohol thing was, from what I understand through sources, and I think my mother may have mentioned this too, that the most powerful Italians that we had in Kansas City during that time were the Savellas and the Camisanos. They were very powerful Italian gangsters. And they ran all, they owned all the liquor stores, they ran all the whatever, the bars and clubs and strip clubs and all that. And they were ruthless in the sense that when every now and then when a truck would come into Kansas City with a lot of beer and whiskey and bourbon and all that on there, they would hijack these trucks. And from what I understand, on a couple occasions, or assignments as they would call it, my father was involved in that, along with some of the other thugs that worked for these guys, and they actually would hijack trucks from time to time and steal all the beer and whiskey, and those Italians would take that same beer and whiskey and put it into their liquor stores and they bar where they wouldn't have to pay for it. Of course, they would do investigations, but these things were well planned and well plotted. So, yeah, then they would give him a big cut of it by letting him take a lot of that whiskey and beer and put it in his body house. Because a lot of the tricks who came to the house with the prostitutes, he would sell them whiskey and beer, and he would sell them drugs, I guess like maybe marijuana or maybe heroin or cocaine or whatever he was selling. And then he would sell them cigarettes too, you know, because he knew how to get contraband cigarettes through different sources. So a lot of the goods that he sold out of his body house, from what I understand, he was getting those goods from the Italians.
You know, and I can understand, and what I really can relate to the fact, and comparing with my own story, and the reason I ask, because see, my grandparents were bootleggers in,
wow,
in Texas, so therefore my parents were bootleggers, and my story was I was in jail at 2 months old, you know, behind,
wow,
some bootleg and stuff. So, you know, that entrepreneurial fire of spirit, you know, was given to me many, many, many years ago. You know, my hustle is different, of course, than,
yeah,
my grandparents and great-grandparents. But the drive I got, you know, I have,
uh-huh,
an exceptional amount of drive. and I hear, you know, and I hear that same drive in you, you know.
Yeah,
where,
yeah, exactly.
You know,
because when you go back in time, when you go back in the time capsule, I've heard quite a few people, whether it was here in Kansas City, St. Louis, Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia, Cleveland, et cetera, there were a lot of people, especially our people, who were pretty much running, you know, like whorehouses, running dope houses. They had their little hustle going on. I mean, I've heard people say right here in KC, yeah, my grandfather and my father, they were running whorehouses, and they were running like after hour joints and all that stuff.
Yeah, they were called juke joints.
Yeah, juke joints. Because like you said, they knew what people wanted. And I'm gonna tell you something, my friend. Al Capone said something one time that made a lot of sense. He said, being that human nature is such that people will indulge in vice, there's always big money to be made in vice, because human nature being what it is, people will always pay to, quote, sin.
That's true.
Yeah.
So tell one other question here. Well, I got a bunch of other questions for you. In doing your research, how different do you see racism, or did you find a lot of stuff talking about racism that your mother and father had to deal with during their era, you know, versus what people today? I know a lot of it is camouflaged more today, but I know it's still very prevalent in today's society.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, from stories that my mother would tell me, that they dealt with a lot of racism, pretty much from both sides, but much worse, you know, from the white community. The hard stares, the hostility, even some of the physical violence threats, you know, because like I mentioned in the book, there was an actual event where the Ku Klux Klan had been watching my mother and father, because there was a chapter, oh, maybe 30 or 40 miles outside of Kansas City, where they were actually watching them. And they had traveled to see his parents, because they lived on his parents, my father's mother and father lived on a farm below, I would say, like maybe 40, 50 miles outside of Kansas City. And on the way back from visiting with them, they actually were stopped by some Klan members. And my father, being the ruthless man he was, being the fearless man that he was, he actually bucked them. And he challenged, because he kept a Colt 45 on him, from what my mom said. He always had a pistol on him. And somehow she was just saying how he was able to threaten his way out of that situation, because they were both staring death right in the face. But as far as, like, the racism, oh, yeah, I mean, they couldn't go in stores without mainly white people looking at them crazy or making racial remarks towards them or pushing them aside with shopping carts and all that, and calling my mother the N-word while he's there. And, you know, and like I said, making threats, we'll kill both of you because, you know, we don't believe in this race mixing. And, of course, you know, at that time, the anti-miscegenation laws were very much in full effect. And to be honest with you, they weren't married at first, but eventually they would get married long after we was even in the foster home. But they even were actually to cohabitate back then was outlawed under the anti-miscegenation laws, which pretty much is relevant to Richard and Mildred Loving up there in Virginia, how they were arrested, you know, for being an interracial couple married there in Virginia, how they had to go to Washington, D.C. to actually get married and make it legal. So, yeah, but to answer your question, though, yeah, as far as the racism, they faced some of the harshest racism that you could ever imagine. And even before they became involved with one another, they knew what they were going to face. I mean, they knew that. I mean, they weren't ignorant to the fact that, oh, everything is going to be so lovey-dovey and so peaceful and we're going to be so harmonious being together. They knew that they were going to, you know, experience a lot of harsh racism.
Mm-hmm. Have you yourself been exposed to a lot of it, being that you got mixed parents?
Well, when I was younger, I did. I mean, don't get me wrong. Now, even to this day, we in the year 2017. I mean, yeah, I still experience racism. I'm going to tell you what a friend of mine's father told me one time. God rest his soul. He's passed on. But he told me, he said, because, you know, he kind of got, when you fair skin and got that curly or straight hair, they'd be like, okay, they know you look mixed, you are mixed, they know that you mixed, even though they don't have to look at your birth certificate to know that. But he once told me, he said, white people probably hate you even more than they would the average black person. I said, why is that, Mr. Hughes? He said, because they don't like mixed race couples, they don't like mixed race children. You know, it's something they believe, oh, people should stick with their own kind type of thing. But, yeah, I mean, because I can recall even, you know, as a kid growing up, that I mean, I was called white boy a lot. I mean, I remember an incident where I must have been in, like, the fourth grade, and I was coming out of – the bell had rung for school to end. So I come out on the playground about to walk home. There's about a good 15 kids, and they all chanting together, white boy, white boy, white boy, white boy. So even amongst us, it was, like, still taboo, like, okay, mixed, you know, like, oh. Because they were, like, just as surprised, like, okay, this kid, my fellow classmate here got a white mother or a black father, either a black mother or white father. And that was strange to them, and that was kind of, like, misunderstood by them, too, because they were taught, no, you don't marry a white person, you don't go with a white person, stick with your own kind. That was instituted so heavily throughout this country until both sides, you know, pretty much say, even though you still had interracial going on, they would still come together no matter how much they knew they would face. But basically, it was a situation where they had ingrained it into people's minds, deep into their psyche. You stick with your own kind. You don't travel outside your own race. But as time went on, we all know the interracial started to more and more become more prevalent and stuff. So, oh, yeah,
we're not going to even blame it on rap music either.
Oh, no, not at all.
We're not going to blame it on rap music either. Or sports. Hey, look, on sports, we're not going to blame it on none of them.
You know what? You're right. You are absolutely right. So, yep. And I know exactly what you're talking about, too. Oh, yeah.
Well, listen, do you feel that writing this story has changed your life in any way?
Oh, yeah, because I have found closure. I mean, it's been therapeutic for me. And, but like I said, but it also just made me feel as though, like, you know, a revelation has come about. And, you know, it's something that it pretty much has opened my mind to so many different things. And how, you know, because I commend them because they're brave souls. My mother and father were brave souls because, like I said, they knew what they were going to face as an interracial couple. But as far as me being concerned, you know, like I said, when I first found out all these things, I just knew deep down that I had a great story. And I felt as though it was something that can benefit both black and white people. I mean, people from many walks of life can read this story and get so much out of it. So it's been very good for me. I mean, I have really, I feel as though it's been like an epiphany for me. And so I just feel as though, man, this is a book that is like one of those rare type of stories to come down the pipeline in a long time.
Well, I know you mentioned earlier that you had the opportunity to meet your mom, but you didn't mention your dad. Did you ever get to meet him, talk to him?
Yeah, I did get to meet him. He had a bad heart. I met him a month before he died. He died of a massive heart attack a month after I met him. And he died in 1978. But I got to know my mother very well. Oh, yeah, we spent some time together, and she would tell me stories. But, you know, I couldn't find out she was a very intelligent woman. I mean, she was a very wise woman. And so I learned a lot from her. And, of course, when I decided to go ahead and, you know, put this book together, a lot of the information that she had given me, as well as, you know, a lot of the documentation, was real helpful in putting the book together. So, oh, yeah, me and my mom spent a lot of time together. And, you know, and people say, well, you know, the question people have asked me, well, do you harbor hard feelings toward? I said, well, I did. I did carry it around, like, on my sleeve for a long time. But I just learned that, you know, they did what they had to do, not to excuse them totally for what they did as far as like abandoning us, me, my brother, my sister, but I came to just realize that they did what they had to do because of the fact they could not provide a stable home for us.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, like when you hustling and you're on survival mode, you moving and grooving and you still trying to think what's best for all concerns, and you're still living life. You're still trying to do the best you can with what you got to work with.
That's right. Yes, sir.
So what's your next step, dude? What you got to plan? What you doing next?
Well, what I would like to do is write a sequel, the next story after Two Shades of Vice, which talks about our staying in this really bad foster home. And It chronicles a lot of the incidents that happened there, and that's quite a story within itself, too. So I'm ready to, pretty much try to put that together, too. And because people that have read the book thus far have asked me, you know, well, you know, are you going to do a part two to this story because the way the story ended and everything? I said, yeah, I would love to, and I think I will eventually. And then, you know, like I said, I love to write. I just love to create. You know, I'm at my happiest when I can sit down and just create and write something that, you know, that's really meaningful to me and hopefully be meaningful to other people. So, oh, yeah, I just want to continue to just keep writing.
Mm-hmm. Let me jump back over on this one really quick. Dealing with racism and mixed relationships and doing your research, do you see a whole bunch of difference in how society dealt with that opposed to how they're dealing with mixed relationships and racism now? You know, because I know every time you turn on the news, you know, we're hearing something about some political figure saying this, saying that, or this and that. Do you see any difference between what was happening in the 60s doing what's happening now versus what's happening now?
Well, I feel as though 50s, 60s, a lot of the lynchings of black men, a lot of the bombing of black churches, especially down south. I believe that racism was very overt back then. I believe that it's still overt to some degree, but I believe it's something that's swept under the rug now. I believe that, you know, they're a little more clever and a little more quiet about, you know, these racial tactics that they execute nowadays. Because my belief is this. I tell you this, my friend. My belief is if something is deep inside in you and it's just really aching to come out, that's what it's going to do. It's going to come out, you know. So, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong. Because of laws being changed, you know, because of discrimination laws and all that, you know, nowadays I believe that, you know, of course, black people, you know, have more civil rights and they have more benefits going on as opposed to the old. Because, see, back in the old days, we all know, I mean, you can walk down the street and a white person can call you the N-word to your face. They can shout it in your face and you just feel as though I have no other choice but to take it. But, I mean, but nowadays, I mean, they do something like that, you know, there's going to be repercussions. You know, there's going to be hell to pay. But as far as, like, racism of old compared to, you know, in modern-day times, I feel as though it's very much still there, no matter what arena that you step into, whether it's in the entertainment business, whether it's in the political arena, or whether it's in, you know, the business world, you know, it's there. I mean, you can try, like I told a friend of mine, it's almost like trying to pretend that Mount Everest is not in front of you when you stand in Nepal. When you're standing in front of this huge mountain, you can close your eyes and pretend that when you open your eyes, it's not going to be there. No, that mountain is still going to be there. So I look at racism the same way. You can pretend that it's not there, and some people are, oh, it's just a way of life, just don't wear it. But no, it'll never be acceptable to me. Because I believe that every man, like Dr. King, every man's created equal. Everybody's the same, no matter how much money you got, no matter what your race is, no matter what your gender is, your educational background. The way I see it from a spiritual standpoint, everybody is equal in God's eyes. But the bottom line is, some people want to pretend that it's not there, but it's very much still there.
Yeah. I definitely agree with that because definitely people, it's just become a little bit more sophisticated. It's a little bit more upscale. It's on the top floor, but it's definitely still there, alive and well, unfortunately.
To put it in better terms, it's institutionalized.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, like one scholar said, like one black scholar said, it's really no different than Microsoft or Coca-Cola or Ford Motor Company. It's an institution. Racism in America is an institution. It's institutionalized.
Wow. I heard somebody tell me the other day is that for if you in professional sports, you know, the first time a black man gets some money, you know, he's not successful until he get a white girl too.
Well, you know what? I tell you this. It's funny you mentioned that because that can be like a 10-hour conversation, really. And okay, but I'm gonna tell you what a friend of mine told me. Matter of fact, this friend is from Chicago. He told me this. Okay, I'm not saying it's 100% excusable or try to mask it or anything, but look at it like this: professional athletes, basketball players, football players, baseball players. The circles that they run in, that's all they see. The parties they go to, the functions they go to, the charity events, et cetera, that's all they see is white women. That's all they see are white women. It's very rare you see too many black faces in the crowd.
Hey,
those guys get introduced to white women. I mean, the owner, the general manager, the coaches, the managers, and et cetera, they introduce these guys to white women. You know, oh, this is Becky, this is Sue, this is John, he plays for the Rockets, or oh, he plays for the Knicks and whatever, or he plays for the Yankees, et cetera, et cetera. So pretty much all them circles that them guys has got, especially when they got that big money, that's all they see are white women. So, yeah, I've heard that stigma, too. It's like, okay, yeah, a black man get rich. 'Cause I heard a black woman say on a talk show one day, she was pretty frustrated. She said, "Yeah, black man get rich. That's the first thing he do is run off and get a white woman. That's the first thing he do. He run out and marry a white woman, you know, and all that." So, yeah, there's that stigma still there that, you know, these especially what, and it doesn't even have to be in professional sports. I mean, it can be in business or it can be in entertainment or whatever. You know, the guy's successful and he rolled in some paper. You know, their thing is, oh, okay, yeah, the first thing he's going to do is go out and run out and marry a white woman. So.
Hey, Dewey, I'm laughing because, you know, as men, you know, we were always taught, you know, we're the head of the household. You know, you get a good job, you take care of your family, your kids, and live happily ever after. But a lot of the mothers was teaching their daughters, when you grew up, you marry a good man, they got a good job, they can take care of you. You know, I've heard a lot of sisters tell me that, look, I'm going to go out and get me a good man, a rich man, I'm going to do this. And I'll be looking at them kind of perplexed because I'd be like, well, where are you going to meet this rich man at? You know, you can't afford to go to the country clubs he go to. You can't afford to pay these $5,000 dinners that they go to. You can't get yourself into these yacht clubs that they belong to. So,
exactly.
You know, that's the flip side of the story that you're talking about, these athletes that are exposed to these different women on these different levels because they're there at these events, you know what I mean, where a lot of minorities, they can't go to these events simply because of a financial situation. They're just
exactly.
not on that level. They're just not
and
there.
And you know what? You've raised a very good point. You are absolutely right. I mean, because of, like, as we say, accessibility. You know,
yes.
that plays a big part. Okay, let's say, for instance, like, the owner of a major franchise may be hosting a party or a charity event or whatever, and his daughter's there. His daughter, who may not be nowhere near as wealthy as that family, may bring a friend or two along with her who don't have the kind of wealth and prominence that she has, but she bring a friend to. And, of course, they're looking around, okay, oh, yeah, there's such and such, and he plays for the Miami Heat and all this. So, yeah, I think accessibility has a lot to play with it. So, you know, but in the end, I think you should be with the person who excites you and the person that you want to be with. I don't care what their race is, you know, and I don't look at race. If that person makes you happy and you all want to be together, then I say you all should be together.
Yeah. I agree with that 150%, man, because, you know, in my career, in my life, I've bumped heads with good and bad everybody, and it has nothing to
do
with the color
you're right.
of that person's skin.
Yes. Like I tell people, I find it impossible for me to be racist because of the fact, even as a mixed-race black man. Now, we talking about my father. We talking about his criminal career and all that, but he came from a family of 11 children. He had 7 sisters and 3 brothers. And I've been fortunate enough to meet some of them, and very nice people. And some of them have gone on to do well in life. I mean, doctors and lawyers and business owners and et cetera. So, you know, I'd be like, okay, well, I can never be that way, you know. And I've never seen myself that way, even though, like, I've experienced it. I mean, as far as, like, racism and, oh, you know, we don't want your kind around here and all that type of stuff. But, hey, that's to be expected because that's just the way life is. You're always going to have people who are like that. But I don't let it get the best of me. I can tell you that. I never do.
No, you can't because there's ignorant people, like I said, all over the world, and I've bumped heads with some of the most ignorant people known to man.
Yes.
And, some of them been black.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I can attest to that.
some of them. So, Dewey, let me see what else we got. You know, you have that book. So let's tell our listeners where they can get in contact with you because we got a few more minutes left. So you can tell everybody
okay.
how they get in contact with you, get your work, and all that good stuff. And I think Olivia and I need a copy of your work as well.
Okay, you know what, and I was going to ask you about it because I definitely want to send both of you guys a copy because you've been so nice as having me on as a guest. My website is www.DeweyReynoldsBooks.com. That's www.DeweyReynoldsBooks.com. Again, that's www.DeweyReynoldsBooks.com. And also, if you want to purchase Two Shades of Vice based on the true story of an interracial couple's life together in crime, you can go to Amazon.com. Like I said, it's available in print edition and also ebook edition. So that's how you can reach out to me.
Yeah, and for definitely, I want to throw this out there, too, you know, for the listeners that joined us late, you know, the show will be available a couple minutes after the show. You can hear it in its entirety everywhere. Just put in Can I Play a Play, and actually you can put in World Movement. You can Google that, or however you get your stuff on iTunes, or, you know, links are on Facebook, LinkedIn, Spotify, and a few other places that you can catch the show from the beginning. Because definitely, we're talking about some good stuff today and more interracial stuff, and we see more and more of that today than ever before on all fronts. And every time you turn on your news, we see something that's going on and look like that's the way of the future. So, do you see anybody doing this and turn this into a screenplay?
Well, you know, as the lady mentioned, the caller who called in, and I mean, like I said, I've sold a few books at work. You know, I've ordered and sold a few, and people who have read the book have said, "Oh my God, I can see this being a movie. I just know this was a movie." And I told them, you know, as I would tell anyone, that I see strong cinematic potential in a story like this. I really do, because it's a rare story. My mom and dad weren't the first interracial couple ever in the history of the United States. I know that. But as far as, like, them coming together and living this life of crime together, you know, and just living on the edge and defying the odds and just blatantly letting law enforcement know we're going to do what the hell we please, whether you like it or not.
Right.
It really tells a very unique and powerful story. So, yeah, I would love to reach out to somebody that, you know, that maybe would find interest in a story like this.
Well, definitely we're going to put it out there to some friends of ours, because I'm thinking about the movie Lawrence Fishburne was in, you know, Harlem. And
You mean that movie where he played Bumpy Johnson?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah,
Hoodlum.
He played
That's
Bumpy
what it
Johnson.
Was, Hoodlum.
Yeah.
Right. I'm seeing some similarities, but some twists. You know,
yeah.
You know, with your dad and your mom, you know, playing their little roles and stuff. But, you know, in that whole era kind of sort of coming up, you know, and, you know, yeah. Look, I better quit putting my twists on. I might get some writer's credits on this.
Oh, man, that's a good one. You got to get some writer's credit on this one.
Yeah, I might need to save my ideas, man, and hit you up with this one when we off the air. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but you know, before we go, you know, and then, like I said, like, okay, when you're looking at entertainment culture, I mean, you look at Robert De Niro. Oh, he loves black women. I mean, you look at a lot of, like you said, there's even a few white women athletes that are married to black men. And I believe there's a couple actresses in Hollywood that are married to black men. And then, you know, you've got a few white men who are married to black women. And then when it stretches even further, I mean, you know, whites and Asians marry. I mean, whites and Hispanics marry.
Right.
Whites and Middle Easterners or whites and Africans and et cetera, et cetera. So I think people affirm to themselves, hey, because I'm one of them, life is too short. And if I live my life trying to please everybody else, then I'm going to get to the end of my life having looking back and just have a lot of regrets. And
right.
Smart people say, I'm going to do what makes me happy. So when I do come to the end of my life, I won't have a bunch of regrets like a lot of people do have.
Very good. Well, thanks again, dude. We got like 26 seconds, and definitely share the show.
Well, thank you, sir. Yeah, how can I send a copy to you and to Olivia?
Email it to us, or you could just shoot us an e-copy, or I'll shoot you the address.
Okay. Do you guys have Kindle? I got the Kindle and the EPUB edition, so I can email that to you?
Either one, yes, sir.
Okay. Now, on a final note, what do you think I could do to, on my end, because I know social media is good, to like Facebook and whatever, Twitter, but what do you think I can do on my end to promote this show or really, but you guys, from your end, you do promote your shows after the interview is over with, is that correct?
Correct. Now,
okay.
We finna shoot it out right now. The Twitter, Facebook, Blog Talk, Radio, LinkedIn, Pinterest, let me see, Google+, about 100 more.
Wow, that's great.
I
appreciate everything that you've done, sir. And, I mean, this interview has been really good for me. And I tell you, I when I can talk about these things, it's almost like another form of therapy for me.
Well, all righty, man, and we appreciate you much, man, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, God bless you, brother. Thank you.
Same to you. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
You know, I've been through so many changes in my life, girl.